Are you ready for the quantum age?
Humanity's next step in evolution?
Dream Vision 7 Radio Network invites you to the extraordinary platform of evolutionary voices for the quantum age.
Let's explore. Learn more about this upcoming age where we bridge science with spirituality.
Where potentiality meets reality.
Where we take compassion into action.
Our trailblazers and visionaries will ask the whys, the what ifs, while igniting continuous possibility.
Come along with us into an age beyond what we know today, where we can grow together in unity consciousness.
Experience evolutionary voices for the quantum age, Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern on DreamVision7Radio.com.
Welcome to the Lifeboat Hour with your host, Carolyn Baker.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost.
Welcome to the new Lifeboat Hour, where each week we bring you extraordinary guests from all walks of life with differing experiences and skills that they generously share with us to navigate the troubled waters of our time. I like to have guests who can do this, and today we have another one of these very extraordinary individuals. And because this podcast always addresses some aspect of our planetary predicament and how to meet it with courage and grace, one of the topics that continues to reappear here is the topic of grief. My guest today is Frances Weller, who's no stranger to the new Lifeboat Hour and whom I consider America's grief sage. But we're not going to simply rehash the topic of grief. Frances was a guest on the old Lifeboat Hour almost 1 year ago and then once before that. And today he and I are going to go into a bit more depth on the topic of grief than we have in the past. Frances Weller is a psychotherapist, writer, and soul activist. He is a master of synthesizing diverse streams of thought from psychology, anthropology, mythology, alchemy, indigenous cultures, and poetic traditions. Author of The Wild Edge of Sorrow, Rituals of Renewal, and The Sacred Work of Grief, he's introduced the healing work of ritual to thousands of people. Frances received a BA from the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay and has two master's degrees from John F. Kennedy University in clinical psychology and transpersonal psychology. His writings have appeared in anthologies and journals exploring the confluence between psyche, nature, and culture. His work was featured in The Sun magazine, October 2015, and he's a frequent presenter and keynote speaker at conferences, bringing insight, poetry, and a breath of humor to his talks. Frances is currently on the staff at Commonweal Cancer Helps Program. He co-leads their week-long retreat with Michael Lerner. He's also taught at Sonoma State University, the Sophia Center in Oakland, and has been the featured teacher at the Minnesota Men's Conference for a number of years. Frances lives and works in Sonoma County, California. Frances, welcome back to the new Lifeboat Hour, and it looks like just today you posted the cover of the Utney Reader on Facebook telling us that they included some excerpts from Wild Edge of Sorrow in their fall issue, yes?
They did. I was very pleased to hear that, and it's a great honor.
Well, good.
You again, Carolyn.
Congratulations, and Frances, you've been exploring the topic of grief, writing about it, and offering weekend grief workshops for several years, but I don't think I've ever asked you to talk about how you were drawn into this work, what drew you to focus in depth in the area of grief. Can you talk about that for a bit?
Well, it was a natural progression from beginning my work in therapy 35 years ago and coming to see how often what people were presenting as depression was more what I would call oppression. It was all the losses in their lives that hadn't really been touched or worked with. And I think I also have a kind of a characterological affinity to melancholy. I think that's a friend of mine that I've come to really appreciate over the time. In fact, I remember reading a while back that in the Renaissance time, they wrote long treatises on melancholy's relationship to creativity. So I think we undervalue melancholy a great deal in a culture just kind of addicted to happiness as its primary meat. And then in the 90s, I began experiencing and learning about ritual process as another way to, in a sense, to reestablish the primary context for addressing grief. So that began another intensive process of experimentation and learning of how to really reestablish that matrix that the psyche has been anticipating our whole life, that we were never meant to be grieving solitarily, nor even just in a therapy room. We need a much wider, much broader context for this work to occur. So that's been a lot of my work over the past, 18 years with the grief ritual work, has been to experiment with forms and shapes to make that a possibility again communally.
Well, I want to talk to you a bit about the indigenous perspective of grief. And when I say that, I don't mean that there's a one cookie cutter indigenous perspective. In The Wild Edge of Sorrow, you write a bit about your experience with attending a grief ritual in West Africa in a Dagara village. And we've talked about that a bit before on this program. Your experiences in the village are riveting to read about, but I just want to share an experience that I had back in the 90s on the Hopi Reservation when I was traveling regularly from Sonoma County, California to the reservation in northern Arizona. And I tell this little story to introduce your thoughts on the indigenous perspective on grief. What happened for me is that I was visiting a friend, an older woman who's living in the village, and it was well known to everybody in the household and the entire community that a friend of hers was very sick and was at death's door. And, people were expecting the news any moment that her friend would be passing. And so while I was there, the news came. And this friend of mine was sitting around with some of the other older women in the village. And when this news came, even though people were expecting it and well aware of it, when the announcement was made, my friend and all of the older women that she was sitting with let out these screams, these wailing, piercing screams that just went through every fiber of my body. And I realized that this was partly ritual, partly what these people had known all of their lives, and that this is what you do in the presence of grief and loss in this culture. It's never taken lightly just because you know that it's imminent. Mm-hmm. I would like you to talk a little bit about the response of the Dagara people in Burkina Faso to grief and how that is handled there.
Well, it begins, I think, with the basic premise, which is that it takes the community, the entire community, to grieve adequately for the soul of the one who has just died. One of their beliefs is that the soul of the one who is departed cannot get to the land of the ancestors without a river of tears. And it's the community's job to weep adequately, to wail, to cry sufficiently to get that boat all the way to the land of the ancestors. Now, whether that's actual, I don't know. That's beyond my pay grade. But what it does is it grants tremendous permission for the entire village. So their funerals last 3 days, not an hour, but 3 days. And over the course of those 3 days, you move through stations. Sometimes you're simply up on the hillside watching. Sometimes you're taking a nap or eating. Sometimes you're down near the family who's grieving and you're wailing with them. Sometimes you're in the dancing group or the drumming or the wailers. You move in and out of these positions through the whole weekend. And what I really got witnessing this was a realization that this was not for the sake of them but a true realization that we will all be in this position. No one is going to be exempt from this truth, that we will all lose someone or something we love, and we will also be the one who has departed. So there's an intrinsic intelligence that we do this together, because today might be your turn, but tomorrow will be my turn.
Yes.
We will all be in the chair. We will all be in this position. So knowing that provided a real ground of certainty, a certain quality of settledness in the psyche. Because one of our deepest fears is that we will face death, we will face illness entirely alone. It's a chronic anxiety in many of us that our conditions are going to be faced solitarily, privately. And so this just shatters that fear. It settles the bones in a way that we can barely begin to imagine in this culture.
I love that notion that today it's your turn, tomorrow might be my turn.
Yes.
We have so forgotten that in this culture. And it's so beautiful to just have that sense of camaraderie and that sense of, you know, well, I don't know for sure, but I'm fairly certain that if I'm in deep pain, you'll be there for me.
Right.
And we just don't have that in this culture. We're so alone with it.
Yeah. When we do the grief ritual weekends, we start off usually, you know, strangers from all over the country. But by the time they leave, they're using the language of village, because something has happened in that process, and you know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
There's a way in which the transparency that comes with vulnerability, with being willing to show the grief we carry, that binds us to one another in unspeakable ways. We can't really describe it, but you can feel it so deeply that we are all in this together. None of us are strangers to loss and to suffering. We're all familiar with it, and we might even laugh while we're together. We might even actually, you know, take delight in the fact that we're together grieving together. So yeah, it's an astonishing thing to have that piece being remembered in our time, in this culture.
Well, one of the things I remember about my very first grief ritual that I did with Melodoma and Subantru is that there was the going down to the altar and the discharging the grief and the coming back from that and being greeted by the village. But over here in one corner was kind of a group of comedy going on. And there were people telling jokes and sharing in joy and laughter. And then maybe all of a sudden they'd think, oh, well, I want to go back to the shrine and discharge the grief. And so there was this amazing mix of all these different emotions. And it wasn't all about, okay, this is all grief and we have to be somber and serious. There was also room for humor.
And well, it allows for a certain fluidity, doesn't it? I mean, we are no longer, when we are stuck with our grief, we harden. I came across this line by this Spanish poet a couple weeks back. I think his name is Jaime Gil de Viedma, who said, I thought all along I wanted to be a poet, but deep down I wanted to be a poem. Isn't that beautiful?
That's lovely.
And that's it. I mean, that's poetic. When we're sitting there in the midst of grief and also over here there's laughter, there's a fluidity. We become verbs in that time. Rather than these singular nouns, we become plural verbs as, what's his name? The neuropsychologist. I just lost his name, but so we're plural verbs, not singular nouns. So when we're in that rhythm and the fluidity of moving in and out of our heart space, we can laugh, we can cry, we can embrace the whole dance.
Yeah, it reminds me of what Michael Mead says about the word emotion. In the word emotion is the word motion. And so feelings, emotions flow and change, and they don't stay the same.
No.
Well, one of the things that we find in indigenous cultures all over the world and that we really talk about in America is the very special place that elders hold. As we all know, in Western civilization, an elder is basically a senior citizen or an old person, and elderhood is defined by age rather than that aging person's place in the community and the wisdom that he or she carries. So from your perspective, what's been the impact in industrial civilization of this loss of elderhood as a sacred role in the community, and how do you think we'd all be different if we viewed elders in this way?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to just acknowledge that their absence itself is a great source of grief for all of us. That this loss of generations of wisdom thins us so desperately as a people that we have basically discharged that source. We have lost that source of experience, of gravity, of depth, of knowing, and have instead turned our attention to a generation of specialness, kind of an idolatry of celebrity status, and even an association towards experts. But we've lost wisdom. We have a lot of information, but we don't seem to know how to live. So these losses of the elders, of true elders, has been profound on our culture. We have a generation of youth right now who feel utterly unseen, and an epidemic of suicide. So there's a relationship between this invisibility and this feeling of not being praised, of not being blessed, of not being valued by the old ones, by the elders, that makes them feel as if they have no worth and no future. If the elders are dismissed, what are we moving toward? You know, there's no shore to arrive at, you know, in a sense, when we dismiss the elders. So this is a profound source of grief. Elders are meant to walk on the street of the community, carrying for us a certain quality of gravity, that they've gone through the turbulence of life. They've encountered it. They've tasted it. And if they've done any work at all, they've come out of it wiser. And they carry a wisdom for us. And we lose that. We call it gravitas, right? They carry gravitas. Someone who walks with a dignified bearing, knowing the full measure of life. They know the joys and the sorrows. They know the heartaches and the losses, the failures and defeats. And they can still meet you. That's profound. That's what we're missing. Elders are what I call practitioners of sustained attention. They know how to witness and identify particularities in those that they see. And because of that, they know how to bless, not generically, but specifically. I see this in you. I see this gift in you. And without that, we feel, again, invisible and, in a sense, spiritually unemployed. We don't feel invited in to bring in our gifts and our medicine. So that's a huge, huge loss. Another quality of the elder is that they have an ongoing relationship with death. So when a culture refuses to hold death in the foreground, it becomes a background malignancy. And right now we are a culture saturated with death. So you can see that there's ripple upon ripple upon ripple of the loss of the elders. We lose so much by their absence. I want to see if there's any more I wanted to mention.
Well, I also find that there's almost sometimes a contempt among younger people for the elders. Now, I know many millennials who really respect elders, but I know many more who don't. And I think that's often true in every generation, but it seems more pronounced right now in our contemporary culture above a certain age, you don't really know anything, and we know everything. And I noticed this a lot when I was teaching in college, that there's sort of this underlying assumption that anybody over the age of 40 couldn't possibly know anything that's worth listening to. And, you know, I keep going back to Michael Mead, you know, who's a friend of ours and a dear mentor in some ways. Mm-hmm. And he talks about when he speaks on both ends of the age continuum, yes. You know, in terms of children and in terms of elders. And he talks about when we stop paying attention to children, they stop having the ability to pay attention. And he talks about, you know, the kind of mythological origins of ADHD.
Right.
And then at the other end, when elders forget who they are, then we forget who are. When we forget the elders, then they forget who they are, speaking in terms of dementia and Alzheimer's.
Correct.
These are mythological meanings. It's not a medical thing. But I think it's really fascinating. What do you think about that?
No, I think that's an exactly valuable way to begin to hold this. Because our approaches of just medically treating it, whether it's through Ritalin for the children or through, you know, different kinds of drugs for the Alzheimer's, we're missing a soul value here of the interplay between these generations and their need of each other. It's like they're dying of a certain loneliness for one another. And the generation that we occupy, or that the 40-year-olds perhaps, as kind of bridges between the elders and the youth, they don't even know what to do. So I think Michael's observations are very, very useful. Again, whether or not it's clinically correct, it gives us a way to approach it. And what we need is imagination around these things. But one other piece I did want to mention about the elders and in our times right now is that the elder has a capacity to hold contradiction and conflict. And in a sense, has the capacity to live life in a much more complex way. We see right now a kind of a devolution into very simplistic ideologies, one-dimensional thinking, either or. It's this way or it's that way. There's no complexity in the thought process. So we're not watching an exchange of elders happening right now. We're watching adolescents battling out for who's right and who's wrong. And this is threatening our entire culture.
Yes, so, yes, indeed.
And, you know, this is what William Blake called single vision. We are dying from single vision. We cannot hold the contradictions and the complexities and the uncertainties. We're always trying to go for the most simplistic ideologies. Fundamentalism, basically, is the solution. It's a dangerous solution.
Indeed. Well, I want to let everyone know that you can contact Francis at francisweller.net. That's WELLER, francisweller.net, where you can read in depth about his work and order The Wild Edge of Sorrow, one of the best books you'll ever read. I absolutely love it. I refer to it all the time. And, you know, it's such a pleasure to be able to talk with Francis today. As you listen to my conversation with guests on the new Lifeboat Hour, you may be one of those folks who has awakened to the depth and severity of the global crisis and humanity's predicament in this moment. But you may be finding that you don't have many people to talk to about it. Often, people are willing to talk about climate change or escalating violence or economic inequality in a general way, but are unwilling to discuss it in depth or share their feelings about these issues. This leaves someone like you feeling very alone. Other people find that amid ecological, social, and political upheavals in our world, they're feeling called to do more with their lives than just observe. For this reason, many people have contacted me over the years in order to have someone that they can discuss these issues with and receive spiritual and emotional guidance for navigating turbulent times. As a life coach and a spiritual counselor with many years' experience, it is my joy and delight to assist people in finding their purpose in the midst of our current chaotic milieu, and also to guide people in living passionately in the face of the numerous unprecedented challenges that we encounter daily. If you're wishing that you could have a deeper conversation with someone about what the global crisis is bringing up for you, I would love to talk with you. To set up a session with me, please contact me at carolyn@carolynbaker.net. I look forward to connecting with you. Francis, one of the essential concepts that you write about in Wild Edge of Sorrow is something you call an apprenticeship with sorrow. And I'd like you to define that notion and then talk to us about the role of an apprenticeship with sorrow in shaping elders.
Well, part of the premise of the apprenticeship is to recognize that we will have an ongoing relationship with grief for the rest of our life. So it is not, we typically talk about it as a period of mourning, and we typically associate that with when we encounter a death of someone close by. We go through a period of mourning, and that's legitimate, that's true. But grief is always around us. And if we do not take up an apprenticeship with sorrow, it's as if we take up a strategy of how do I avoid this? How do I outrun it? Which you can't. How do I distract myself sufficiently from it? So the idea of an apprenticeship, just like the old ideas of apprenticeship from the guild programs where you would study to become a weaver or an ironsmith or whatever, it took years of practice, years to learn how to handle the material. Mm-hmm. The same is true for grief. It takes years of knowing how to handle the heaviness, the weightiness, the lead of sorrow, of how to work with it, how to learn to accompany it, how to begin to trust it. And in the old language of apprenticeship, you became a master. After many, many years of apprenticeship, you became a journeyman or whatever, then you became a master at the end. Well, I think here we're talking about a long apprenticeship with sorrow is what leads to elderhood. It is the ripening, it is the slow maturation, it is the deepening of a human being into someone who can walk now in the world with the full experience of being alive and having turned away nothing. You've walked into the full breadth of life and you've said yes to it all. That is the tempering of an elder. Now, the apprenticeship itself, how I understand it, requires coming into some ongoing, sustained relationship with grief. Just to really acknowledge that you can't outrun it. And to begin to cultivate a certain faith that it's not there to take you hostage. It's actually there to do something deep in your soul. The second thing is to then develop some kind of practice as a way of helping yourself stay steady when those bigger currents of grief hit us. You know, when, I'm dealing with couples right now, families who've lost children and are facing their own death through cancer. And I mean, heavy, heavy waves of grief come in the door. And if we are not well ballasted, you know, with something that can really help steady us, we are easily knocked over. And the third part of that apprenticeship that I write about is making sure that it's the adult part of us who's facing this grief. And this happens all the time in here in my practice, but also in weekends, when you see the look of terror come over someone's face when grief comes close to them. And you know you've just left the adult behind and you're now sitting with a very frightened 5-year-old child. And how do you learn to migrate that grief back into the adult's hands? That's a huge part of the work, because many of us did not have our grief held in our early life. So that part begins to feel as if grief does not have a bottom to it. And you probably have seen this too, Carolyn, that when grief sometimes shows up for somebody, it isn't just a pure grief moment. It's a grief panic. It's a grief terror moment. And if we can slowly help to take the fear off of it, then we can begin to actually have some faith that it's just grief and I can be with this. As long as I'm not alone, I can be with this. And then ironically, go ahead.
Well, no, I'm just thinking that when you have an apprenticeship, it's a very serious thing. And the whole intention is to learn how to make something. And so in this apprenticeship, we remake ourselves. I've never seen anyone who's committed to grief and allows the grief and goes into it consciously who isn't in some way remade in their life. And so it is some of the most transformative work that can possibly be done.
That's utterly true. I often use the phrase, particularly with the cancer patients, that they've entered a rough initiation. It's not something they have chosen, but it is something that's come into their life, and it has the same impact as any true initiation. It severs you from the life that you once had. It's a radical change in your sense of identity. There's a profound sense that I can never go back to the life that I had. So you are put in this cauldron of intensity, and hopefully you come out radically altered. We're not supposed to come out of these things the same as we went in.
You know? Exactly.
So yes, anybody who undertakes the apprenticeship, hopefully through their own efforts, comes out radically changed. So last piece about that apprenticeship I just want to throw in there is self-compassion.
Sure.
And the reason I say that is because, and you know this as well as I do, how mercilessly tough we are on ourselves. We rarely even pause to acknowledge how hard we are. I did a grief ritual for environmental activists some time ago, about 60 of us together, and we did the ritual, and after the ritual was over, a woman shared, well, I was up there at the shrine and I had so much grief, but I don't think I got it all out. You know, what should I do? As if she'd done something wrong, you know? So I said, well, let's pause for a second. And can you just appreciate what you did today? Can you just say, I walked in the door? Can you just say, I did what I could today on behalf of the greater good of the planet? I wept. And everyone's heads just started nodding. Just like we're always pointing a finger at what we failed to do.
Right.
But rarely do we pause and just say, good job. No, thank you for doing that.
Exactly.
That was enough.
Yes, yes.
Just to bless ourselves for a moment. Yeah. So self-compassion.
Thank you for that. And, you know, as you and I know, sometime before Thanksgiving, my dear friend Andrew Harvey and I are going to be releasing our new book, Return to Joy. And you've graciously consented to write the foreword for that book. It's an extremely powerful book. It's short. It's a piece of dynamite that comes in a small package and that reaffirms the saying as such. One of the things we adamantly point out is the relationship between grief and joy. And I know that you witness this in yourself and in the people who attend your grief workshops, as I do with people who attend mine. Perhaps we could both talk about this, but I'd like you to begin.
Well, you've heard me talk frequently about the flatline culture.
Yes.
And
talk about that in the book as well.
Yeah.
Flatline culture. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. This compression that we're under to live in a very narrow range of acceptability as far as our emotional lives go. And so we abandon this deeper register of grief, sorrow, melancholy, longing, loneliness. I mean, these are difficult emotions. But when we abandon that territory, there's a simultaneous collapse in our capacity to know genuine joy. It's as if the foundations of the house happen in that deeper register, but we cannot build anything on top of that. So we're left bereft of joy, enchantment, delight, awe. I mean, these all come from a kind of similar territory. But as you and Andrew say, I think quite beautifully in your book, is that joy is not a state-dependent experience. It's not dependent upon whether or not everything's going great in my life, you know, whether I've got a big bank full of money or, you know, a nice car. Joy is its own terrain, its own acknowledgement of the deeper course of life, of the deeper source of life. And you do a beautiful job, I think, of giving us ways to access that again. But I'd like to hear some of your thoughts about that, too.
Well, you know, I know that you see this as well with your grief workshops. People tell me often at the end of a grief workshop, you know, we finish in the afternoon and usually have the Saturday evening free. And sometimes people just want to rest and sleep. Sometimes people want to dance and play and sing. But usually the next day someone tells me, wow, I slept better last night than I've slept in years. Or, you know, I had these amazing, wonderful dreams. Or I have this level of joy inside of me that I don't think I've ever experienced before. Mm-hmm. I feel such lightness today as a result of what I did. And then maybe, you know, months later, I kind of hear the same thing. Well, yeah, my grief has deepened, but so has the quality of my joy. And so it's that wonderful reality that Mary Oliver talks about when she says grief and joy, what a pair these are. They travel together in the same body. And so we cannot separate them. They're inextricably connected.
No, and you're so right. I mean, our access to joy has to come through a permeable heart, right?
Yes.
So that heart permeability is so connected to our ability to grieve, because that's what we call the congestive heart failure, right? When we refuse to grieve, the heart does congest, and we lose that accessibility and that fluidity of moving in and out of the heart. I came across this passage in a book called Feeling Wisdom by Rob Preece, who's talking about his time when his teachers from Tibet came over, his meditation teachers came over, and they said that what they witnessed in us is a damaged or blocked, a damage or blockage in the primary energy winds of the heart chakra. Mm-hmm. Beautiful phrase. The primary energy winds of the heart chakra is supposed to be this flow, this exchange between inside and outside, this moving in and out. But they say that our hearts have become blocked and the flow has been ceased by our premature forced independence, by our not being able to rely upon a steady community, by our hyper-individualism. All these things they say really have caused this heart blockage to appear. So I think the grief work is so critical to beginning to loosen that blockage back up again and open us up to that permeability. And when we do that, it is a natural it's just inevitable that we taste joy. Mm-hmm. You know, I've known more joy in the past 10 years than I knew my whole life.
Yes, I believe that, and I as well.
So much more joy in my life, yeah. Beautiful book, by the way.
Well, Francis, I don't know if you've seen the movie How to Let Go of the World and Love the Things That Climate Can't Change from Josh Fox, who did Gasland 1 and Gasland 2. It's a movie that very clearly invites those of us who are heartbroken about catastrophic climate change not to send away the grief, but to hold it alongside the joy in our lives. The movie begins and ends with the filmmaker dancing joyously as in between the beginning and the end, he shares with us the heartbreak he's experienced as an anti-fracking climate activist. Now, whether or not you've seen the movie or our listeners have seen the movie, I'm wondering, Francis, if you'd share your thoughts and feelings about this notion of holding joy alongside what we're living through right now in terms of climate catastrophe.
I think the invitation is one of becoming immense. I think we are being asked to cultivate the outrageous courage of the Bodhi heart, as Pema Chodron would say. Mm. This immensity is something that is asking us to be able to stretch ourselves in ways that we are able to hold multiple things at the same time. At a recent retreat, a woman was sharing about a trip she took down to the Grand Canyon. And she had this profound experience of feeling connected to this immense space in front of her, that she was part of it. And then she came back, and a few weeks later was diagnosed with advanced ovarian cancer. Mm-hmm. And she was sharing her story, and she just felt so small at that moment. I said, wait a minute, just pause for a second. What happened to the woman standing at the Grand Canyon? Where is she? She says, what do you mean? That woman felt so large. Mm-hmm. Can you recall that? Can you remember her? Mm-hmm. Began to feel back into that space. And now her cancer had someplace to be held. You know, when something like that hits us or climate catastrophe overwhelms us, we tend to collapse. We join the collapse, don't we?
Right.
So the invitation is one of becoming large, to become immense, to become capable of holding the most difficult, most painful information, and at the same time to be able to see how exquisitely beautiful this world remains. And we cannot lose sight of that. We'll either, if we turn only towards the hideous, the terrible, the difficult, the painful, our lives will shrink in bitterness. And if we only turn towards the light and the beauty, we will become kind of a shrunken residue of somebody who knows how to respond to what's actually happening. But together, these two presences actually cause us to become something quite large. Hafiz once wrote, the small man builds cages for everyone he meets, while the sage, who has to duck his head when the moon is low, keeps dropping keys all night long for the beautiful rowdy prisoners. Mm. You know, we're invited to get immense in this life.
Yes.
It should be hard to walk out the door.
You know? Right.
But we feel so small, we feel so insignificant, we feel so inadequate. And on one level, that's all true, but at the other level, that's not what we're being asked to do right now. It's an initiatory threshold that we're at. And we are being asked to really go through these stages of our own lives to become as large as we possibly can. That's the invitation. I think that's the demand of our time.
Thank you for that. Well, Francis, we're coming down to the end of this podcast, and I'm wondering what workshops or rituals you're planning during the remainder of this year and into 2017. And I'm not sure, but I think there's another book in the works. Is that true?
Rumor has it.
Yeah, okay.
I'm working on a couple projects, which I will definitely let people know about in the next, hopefully next few months. Workshop-wise, partly it's a hiatus for workshops for the rest of the year, so I can finish these writing projects. But 2017 will have retreats all over the place, British Columbia, Portland, Madison, Santa Cruz. So just come to the website and you'll find where I'm going to be, and hopefully something in your neighborhood. Come and join us and taste the sweetness of joy and sorrow living side by side.
Well, I highly recommend going to Francis' website and seeing what he's up to and attending a grief ritual if you possibly can, and certainly reading The Wild Edge of Sorrow. FrancisWeller.net is the website. That's where you want to go, and The Wild Edge of Sorrow is the book you want to read. You really do, trust me. That
I really
want
do.
To read that book. So, Francis, thank you so much for being with us today on the New Lifeboat Hour, and thank you, listeners, for joining us. And until next time, stay well, stay safe, and stay awake.
Thank you for joining us today. You can hear all podcasts and learn about Carolyn Baker's other works at www.carolynbaker.net. Her daily news digest is available by subscription and is delivered to your inbox 7 days per week with real news on economics, environment, geopolitics, civil liberties, and cultural issues, plus links to articles on inspiration and resilience. Come sail with us again next week on the Lifeboat Hour.